right. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to No Downtime, a podcast from Fort Rock Data Center here located in beautiful Central Oregon. Connor and Levi here with you again, and today we're fortunate to have Tim Moravaco back on the pod to dive a little bit deeper into his background and to get a different perspective on the data center industry and some current trends. So welcome back, Tim, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we'd like to get to know a little bit more about your early experiences with computing and software engineering, and then, of course, have a discussion on some current trends, where you think the biggest innovations will be made with what's going on right now.
Well, it's nice to think about one's past achievements.
Yeah.
However, you know, my experiences, they're not that much different than everybody's experiences out there. And so the way I see it is, I'm just a humble person. And the way I look at it is, from time to time, you think about it, it's like, well, you did this achievement, that achievement, but in the end, it's all become collective achievement. And so that's why I always prefer to see my advancements in the context of what are the things that are happening. The way I got, for example, in the database, that's an interesting thing for experience for myself, was I found fascinating the idea of data. It's just, what is data? You know, what is knowledge? And how do you extract data and how do you group it together? And so I remember quite some time ago when I was thinking about it, it's like, what do you do? How could you actually have knowledge in the form of database? What is that? What does it actually mean? And so that aspect of it, for many, it's not immediately obvious. And then database, from that perspective, that's kind of a mechanism that effectively distills those life experiences or knowledge into a way that we can share with each other. If you think about it, it's like a glue that connects the people. And when you look at, for example, Wikipedia or these concepts and the encyclopedias and things of that sort, and the written language and verbal communication, all of that is the mechanism for us to exchange data. The trend will be into unlimited databases. We haven't gotten there yet, but we are going in that direction. And so that part of enormity of data is the big question that we'll be all confronting as a society, because with all of our experiences, even to this day, we all, if you think about it, of the internet, what is internet? Internet is a collective mechanism of actually allowing for people to share the experiences. But another part that I kind of briefly mentioned at the beginning is, how do you structure the data? That is the question that was confronted. People looked into it. The questions were centered about manipulation of data and how do you extract knowledge from the data, because people realized that, for example, statistic information is data, but it's not necessarily knowledge. And that's where the programming languages came in.
How'd you first get into computing, software engineering, and programming languages? Was there, what got you interested initially, I guess?
I first learned the concept of programming on actually programmable calculators. And it's a path that many people took. And one has to have a certain, sufficiently developed imagination to transform blinking numbers on a one-line calculator into a concept of, for example, I remember that I programmed, I guess you can sort of call it a video game, because without the video part,
cool.
It's purely in your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And I programmed it, a calculator was calculating how to land a spaceship, I suppose. It's also an imaginary spaceship on the moon, on the imaginary moon just mm-hmm. as well. And so the way it was, I figured out that, there's a concept of gravity, a thrust, how much the thrust you need to have to, and then there's an element of simplified system of using the gravity to land that object on the moon. And so you're just kind of trying to land it without crashing and by inputting various numbers. In a sense, it was nothing more than a model that I just programmed. And that element of it was, I suppose, the first one of the first programs that I made. And the second one, I think that was actually also quite hilarious. I made a model for, I think it was a market or something like that, where you sell something, you have a supply demand, and using a calculator, and you just imagine that this number, blinking number, and it blinked at the time. And so the calculators, and they were very small. And so you only had, I think, probably like 12 digits. And so it was more advanced calculator. So it had A, B, C, D, E, F. As well, so it's not only digits and stuff. And I think it had the capacity of 120 commands or so. So the one had to figure out how to program the whole thing, plus imagination. And after that, I delved into the world of computer languages to figure out conceptually what the languages are. And that whole part about computer languages, that's why I brought it up. Conceptually, it's a thing that I find that many people misinterpret what's the computer language. But yet computer languages, for example, it was the very thing that empowered the population. As I, previously we talked about personal computers. And personal computers, many people imagine that personal computer is some kind of thing that does something for a person. But fundamentally, personal computers, one can't divorce from programming languages. Because the first personal computers, the sole reason people bought them, they had no apps in a general mm-hmm. sense. And so what did you get? That Altair machine had on the front panel, 16 switches and probably 15 blinking lights. And that's, so by comparison, the calculator that I was using would have been a kind of quite an advanced system. But the whole point of it, why people bought it, is because it gave them that power of a programming language, which was BASIC at the time.
I do want to go back to something you said really quick, where you mentioned, the possibility of unlimited databases, because that's very interesting. So is this where we're going to see computing going in the future? I mean, you're already seeing that right now with Levi mentioned TurboQuant from Google, which is, works to reduce that memory footprint for large language models through that, a new compression reducing algorithm. So is this where you kind of see the advancements being made, is continuous compression that maybe allows those unlimited databases?
Well, it's very good that you asked about the concept of unlimited databases, because I took it further. When I came up with this idea that wouldn't that be great to have, ever-expanding database, and that's when I invented that concept of strings, the concept where that at one point you kind of get to this realization that if we live in the world of data, essentially we ourselves, the processors of that data. But the problem is, if you try to comprehend data from perspective of unlimited database in terms of you just able to capture everything at once, it can't be. It's illogical. The logic will just put a wall in front of you that you can't get through. You can't break through that wall. And the reason so is because of that contradiction. We can only see a snapshot of data, which means that in reality, the data has no beginning and it has no end. When I realized that, when I was thinking about it in terms of what the structure of the data should be or could be, I came to a conclusion that in reality, the data is like a string that kind of has no beginning and it has no end. And all you're doing is that you're just seeing fragments of it here and there. And the most interesting part about the data is ability to make those connections. And that's why they, one could say that the brains of humans have those neurons and they all connect to random pieces of data. And that may well be because there's conceptually, essentially what it means is that the data could become so multidimensional where everything is interconnected to everything else and therefore you acquire new knowledge. That potentially is where things could go, but I don't really think that it's likely going to go in that direction. What I think is going to be happening, I really think that we're on the cusp of another personal participation. The problem with computers overall became that it's not the fact that they're unable to process overwhelming, supposedly, amount of data. That problem has been generally solved by just simply bulking up the storage. The problem right now is, what's the purpose for the data? They say, well, the purpose is for AI to come in and analyze it and teach us how to live our lives. It's illogical because AI cannot predict the future based on the past. That property of the future, you can't alter. So as a result, at most, you could say the probability that something could happen or something doesn't happen. But look at all of the endless predictions that there would be no financial crisis, there would be no this, no that. And every time it happens, people say, well, you know, humans make mistakes. So tomorrow they're going to be say AI makes mistakes. Well, AI makes mistakes today. You don't need to wait for tomorrow.
Lots of mistakes.
So going back to the question as to, would it be the future hold unlimited data? No. I would say that the debate right now, and people have to actively vote individually, are they going to submit to the machine, literally, or they will be programming the machine? Do you see the distinction mm-hmm. there? Because mm-hmm. who is the master? People have to realize that for as long as they type and put their energy and effort in inputting data in the form of the emails, texts, videos, photographs, and give it away, where is the personal element there? It's nowhere there. Somebody takes it and says, thank you. And in the end, they go back and say, well, don't I have any rights so that you don't use my texts that I sent or messages and stuff? So that way, because I want to erase them now. And it's like, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Because now we own it.
Yeah, that was page 3,000 of the 4,000-page terms and agreements.
Yeah, so, yeah. Right.
That's a good one.
You clicked on the EULA box. I don't know what it said. But I tried to download the PDF. The file's too large.
Right, exactly.
No, I see that with kids, though. Like, right? They use GPS to go everywhere. And so my daughter, after working at the same place for a couple months, she's like, well, I got to go, when I was talking to her on the phone. I said, why? And she goes, well, the GPS tells me where to turn. I go, isn't this like your like sixth week going to work? Don't you know the names of the streets and the landmarks? Yeah, but I just feel better when I know that I'm just like, oh, wow, she's a slave to GPS. And that scared me because I'm like, wow, okay. How many other people are like, going to work, been working here for 5 years, need to keep my GPS on? I mean, I've seen them on the freeway.
Oh, yeah.
Day after day after day, they always have their GPS. And I'm like, are you guys going to the same place? Like, because I see you on the same place on the freeway every day.
Yeah.
But you got your GPS on, like, you're like, oh, we're going somewhere new.
Yeah.
We better make sure we don't deviate from the...
Just yesterday I was heading somewhere where it was a road closure that was closed the previous week,
uh-huh.
and it said it would still be closed, but I was like, yeah, I'm just going to go this way just to see if it's still closed. Google, I had my GPS on, admittedly, even though I knew exactly where I was going, but I was just curious, and Google still showed that the road was closed, but uh-huh. I show up, and albeit it's not closed, so
yeah.
Well, that part, I think that is a very important part in terms of generational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. I'm curious. I want to go back to something else you said really quick, where you mentioned, you know, computing wasn't necessarily meant to be personal. So where do you see smaller data centers like Fort Rock, for example, fit in with how you see that, you know, personal computing versus cloud or corporate computing? What do you think that's going to look like in the future?
Well, I think that it has a very big potential for people to reclaim the power. Having a data center that is more aligned with the interests of the public or in the locality has a potential to have support of that locality. And that is a big difference. In the stormy days that I would be coming for data centers, the big data centers would have a tendency to sink, not float, because the question would become, who is the support? Where is the support? And it's a lot more likely for the data centers to be profitable and appreciated, the ones that focus or face toward the public and say, come on in, try new ideas. And that is more likely to survive, because it's already happened many times and it's a constant thing. When you effectively jump on the bandwagon, if you're early, you get the reward. If you're the last one to jump, well, you're the one holding the bag. And with data centers, I would say that it's a lot realistic that the smaller, nimble data centers would survive and thrive. Because at the moment, it's hard to see that public would be again interested in computing. But I do think that is coming, because that realization has to happen pretty soon, that personal data has to be personal for it to work for the person. And with the data centers, the big data centers right now, they're just riding the hype. And I would say that that hype is, well, they finished riding the hype, I think, at the end of last year. So right now, they're just hoping for a little bit extra hype to kind of refuel the tanks. But yeah. The show, in my opinion, is over already. And it's evident by the fact that a number of them are unable to attract customers, and they just have that there. It will pressure smaller data centers, no doubt, in the short term, because they would have fire sales, and it's just the reality today. But in another 12 to 24 months, the reality would be shifting when they will be closing the doors. However, it doesn't mean that, essentially, for the smaller data centers, that going back to that question as to, I think that the bigger question would be whether the public and the people will choose personal versus corporate. Mm-hmm. And that's that moment when the pendulum starts swinging in the opposite direction, because it has no capacity to expand any further in the same direction. So today, people are, I think, starting to look at the idea of what data is and that why they need that. I remember how I was discussing quite some time ago saying that absolutely it would make perfect sense to have a personal database, for example, to keep track of your thermometer. And people were telling me that that is just so crazy. Who would want that? Who would want to have, you know, information about the thermometer, data for the last 3 years in your house? And I'm like, oh, I think everybody would. And look at it today. People are realizing it is kind of quite handy, because it takes time to understand what the utility for that. And so as a result, that aspect of it, society has to be ready, but they can only become ready after GPS tells them, go here, go there a few more times, and they get tired of it, listening to that nonsense, because it is nonsense. And that realization is very, very critical.
Yeah. So maybe a little bit of an abstract thought here, so bear with me. But you mentioned something I thought was really interesting. You said oldie but a goodie. And I definitely think that's true with so many things. But where do you see this going? Do you think that we're too connected? Do you think that people are going to go back to the oldies but the goodies? We're seeing trends in people actually, you know, giving up their smartphone for home phones again. I mean, do you see that as the trend where people are actually kind of simplifying their connected life? Or what do you think?
I see it. The short answer is oldies, goodies, what I think we are going. That is, but that it's different in the way you described versus the way I think it's going to actually happen. Let's break it down a little bit. Would people abandon fiber to their homes? The answer is no, it will not happen. Would people abandon the smartphones in its current incarnation? Yes, they will. So what does it mean? Does it mean that there would be no smartphone-like devices? No. The difference will be soon there would be overwhelming demand that people want to reclaim their privacy. And to give an example, to underscore that same idea, I was reading an announcement by a company who purchased, Jason can look it up, Commodore 64.
Oh, wow.
flip phone. Why are they doing it? Because they sent, you see, the flip phones right now you can buy from China, you know, inexpensively. It's a very simple, but simple or not simple, there's a fundamental battle is going on right now. So going back to the question of the smartphones, would they be the same? The concept would remain, but fundamentally what's going to be changing is people would want a system in which they have control, essentially the oldie, goodie, where they have a choice to tell smartphone not to be connected. I do think that flip phones are going to be coming back and more, and most importantly, devices, small devices that people will start learning to integrate into their lives with their own permission. Mm-hmm. But the cloud, it's over. And that going back to your question of small data centers, if the small data center is integrated in the concept of the cloud, that's a serious risk, because declouding is going to be rapid and brutal in the sense that people would just simply choose to go somewhere else.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I might have brought this up last time. I don't remember, but I had to put together a slideshow for the seniors that were graduating for my daughter. So I went ahead and paid a little bit for extra Google storage because it was convenient for everybody to drop their photos into OneDrive, and I knew that it would fill up. Well, somehow, I don't know how, but somehow my profile started backing up everything.
Ah.
Now that I was, you know, paying 49 cents for a introductory 3 month, you know, where it bounces up to, I don't know, 35 bucks, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where pretty soon it was full and I had gone from like 15 gigs to 100 gigs or I don't know exactly what it was. Or maybe it's 25 gigs, I forget.
Yeah.
But it was full fairly quickly. And I was like, you know, it's going to be never ending. And nobody wants to throw out like your old photos,
of course.
You know. Oh, but that's when she was in kindergarten, her first day of school. I can't delete that. You know, so it's kind of funny because you think you own the photos, but they're like, hey, you can lease them from us for, you know, a few dollars a month. Oh, and by the way, if you want to keep all of them, we're going to up the ante because you need more, as time progresses, you need more storage space. So it's kind of funny how they tie in with Google, your Gmail, and instead of saying, hey, you're not going to be able to store additional photos, they say, hey, you're going to stop receiving email because your drive is full. All of your storage is used up. And I'm like, well, email is kind of more important than photos. Or a video of a basketball game when they were five, you know.
Sure.
So, but I mean, that's the business model that Microsoft and Google and Apple have all adopted because they see that monthly recurring revenue.
Oh, yeah.
At a certain point, we're going to experience, you know, app fatigue and death by a thousand paper cuts.
Well,
where we're like, oh, I can't afford this. Oh, it's only $3 a month. It's only $10 a month.
Well, there's eventually going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you used to be able to purchase Adobe Photoshop.
Oh, yeah.
And now it's a monthly recurring subscription, and that's what the economy is kind of based on.
Well, yeah, an interesting thought that I wanted to give you a perspective, as Levi was describing. What you just described is exactly, just consider the evolution of the telephone. It's very instructive, and if you were to look at the bigger picture, at first it was, well, as long as you pay us, we'll bring a line into your house, and then you can talk to whomever you want. You own it.
Mm-hmm.
Little by little, it became a situation, well, the government has to break up AT&T. And so you get the seven baby bells. And because they got too big, they all squelched innovation and everything else. And the AT&T is trying to say, well, we kind of bring in some innovation, a little bit, you know, at least something. And so the message was, it got to the point of the ridiculous, and people didn't notice how absurd it became per minute. So you have to pay per minute. So that way, you better, you know, be quick on your messages and don't go too crazy there.
The chatting. Long distance.
Exactly.
Oh, man. Don't call Eastern Oregon. It's 10 cents a minute.
Don't
that
text anybody before 8 p.m.
That conversation's going to cost you a couple bucks.
Yeah. But that my point is, I'm going back on this email, it's very interesting how today, you know, if somebody were to ask somebody 20 years ago, can you imagine that people will have no personal email? People say, no, that's not physically possible. It's absurd. The internet, the whole idea of the internet is that people would have their own personal stuff. But today, 75% of all emails is Gmail. And I looked at the numbers at one point, and the numbers, who is producing all the spam? It's like, whoa, it's bad guys. And it's like, well, let's take a closer look. Who are those bad guys? Because fundamentally, it's absurd. If it's all the bad guys and it's 75% of the market, there got to be a connection between that bad guy and 75% of the market. Because otherwise, the bad guy can't address that. The market for the bad guy would be all so small, there's no point. Do you understand the idea is that the marketeers of the bad stuff can't possibly be in business if they're addressing only a sliver of the market, and all of the Gmail customers are protected from the spam, which means that spam is another boogeyman as well as the viruses. Because you see, like in my experience, I saw the viruses unfold from the very beginning to extinction, and then the rapid evolution, because virus is a very important concept. You can't possibly get people to abandon their freedom without a threat to their security.
Mm.
And as long as there's a bad virus somewhere, you need to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And since you can't figure out what to do yourself, you know, somebody has to help you.
Yeah. So this is very interesting because this leads into something I wanted to ask. Obviously, you know, we've seen a big boom in cybersecurity solutions and ever-increasing threats to home and business networks. So what have you seen in what you're doing to develop, you know, your network and packet capture technology? What are the big things going on right now?
Well, the reality is simple as spying. That's as simple as that. Because the reality is that aspect of it, for majority of people, they prefer to just do enough in hopes that it wouldn't be them, but at the same time realizing that there's not a lot they can do, because packet capture is a very important aspect of any network because it gives you two tools that are invaluable. And one of them is ability to see the packets as they are, so which means that you can determine if there's a technical problem. And the second, ability to see what data is moving. So is it good data or bad data? It's a reality of today that if you don't know what is being transmitted, you effectively consenting to wholesale spying. Mm-hmm. But the amazing thing is it's so easy to stop it because fortunately for us, unfortunately for them, they are not that savvy from a perspective of technology. And it's not because they're stupid. They have to use a system that scoops up everything. So whatever spying mechanism they have, it has to be so broad. And because of that broadness, they have to rely on elements within their spying techniques that are easy to circumvent. And the key to it is sabotage. Because timeout is not necessarily a problem, but repeated timeouts for them means privacy for you, which means that whatever information is gathered, you just simply time it out. And that's one of the techniques that we came up some time ago to help customers if they want to. But in terms of packet capture right now hit that element without decryption. Packet capture is not as valuable of a tool, which we'll talk about some other time, which we, to counteract that, we added the ability to decrypt the traffic, and that way you can see for yourself. And they knew that it's coming. It's all they knew that somebody will do that. And to counteract that, you will see that what was added is secure domain technology, which is a parallel system to the normal domain name system that they trying to shift it to make it private, which means that, for example, if you enable it on your phone or computer, you can go through Google. So Google would tell you which websites are approved by Google. And naturally, you would only be able to go to only those websites or specific versions of them. And again, that's all of those elements that what we're working on is to give that power of control, of choice, back to the people.
Yeah. One more thing I kind of thought of, you know, you mentioned the pendulum swings back, right? And that it's going to be up to the people to kind of reclaim their privacy. I'm curious your thoughts on the energy usage required by hyperscaled facilities and AI-focused facilities. Do you think that that's going to be part of that pendulum swinging back? Or are we just going to find more ways to be more and more efficient with energy to where it's just not going to matter anymore, you know?
Well, it's the question is very broad because if you think about it comes down to the question whether or not the public would be willing to yield to AI, which means to defer more and more to AI, or AI would go back in its place. And that is a fundamental question that would have to be answered pretty soon, because the energy use in the AI is used primarily due to the repetitiveness nature of AI and the large amount of information that it needs to, which means that it needs to maintain larger storage. I believe that the data is going to backflow into the hands of the people. Mm-hmm. So which means AI would fundamentally would just become a tool like many, and people will reclaim their right to exist in the world in terms of whether it's digital or otherwise. And that means that the power need for AI necessarily would just go down, because there's no advantage for society to create these nodes where there would be a lot of information stored. It makes more sense for societies to store their experiences with themselves, not because they want to delete it, because they want to modify it, but because they can derive more knowledge from that information and by sharing that information. Because if you think about it, if the data is stored in the form of data centers in the nodes, it means that whoever controls them controls the exchange of that information. So fundamentally, it deprives the society, individual members, the active individual members, for example, students who want to do research, they can't without the approval of whoever owns the data. Mm-hmm. But if in a community, for example, the data is stored locally, people just can go up and say, hey, can I use some of your data, and they share. And that is the fundamental question, personal versus corporate. Corporate, you pay for it, you pay a rent for something that you already own. Because in that case, it's absurd. It's a tax of absurdity. That conceptual, when the data is stored in central location, it becomes a tax of absurdity for the society. Mm-hmm. And that's why, going back to that question of AI, would they get bigger, more hungry for power? I don't think. I mean, in the short term, they can continue going in that direction, but it's fundamentally against the grain of civilization.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I think that's maybe a nice place to wrap things up. Awesome discussion. Thank you so much for lending us your time again. That's really going to do it for us today on this episode. So if you like this episode, please give us a like and a subscribe. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Pocket Casts, YouTube. And then you can also listen right on our website at fortrockdc.com/no downtime. So for Levi, Jason, and Tim, I'm Connor Williams, and we'll catch you next time here on No Downtime. Thank you so much. Fort Rock Data Center is a purpose-built facility strategically located in the high desert of Bend in Central Oregon. We offer reliable business continuity and edge computing solutions that meet SOC 2 Type 1 compliance in a low-risk environment east of the Cascade Mountain Range. Learn more at fortrockdc.com. Background music by Maxim Malko from Pixabay.
The GPS couldn't be wrong.
There's some Tesla drivers that tend to think that way. I have to go that way. It's tell me to go. Exactly. I can't fight it.
I think I need to be nicer to my Google Home, maybe.
Alexa has a mean streak.